Two finance managers apply for the exact same job in Sydney.
All right, it happens every single day.
Yeah, and they have the identical title on their CV, the exact same number of years in the industry, and, you know, the exact same core qualifications.
On paper, they look like clones of each other.
Spot on. Yet, according to a massive new data set we're looking at today, one of those candidates is statistically worth up to $110,000 more than the other.
Wow.
And that is just on their base salary alone.
It's staggering, isn't it?
It really is. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, our mission is to cut straight through the corporate noise and give you a genuine shortcut to understanding what finance professionals are truly worth in Sydney in the year 2026.
Because as it turns out, your job title has essentially become, well, a meaningless wrapper.
Completely meaningless.
Yeah.
And it's a reality that's currently causing absolute chaos, isn't it?
Oh, utter chaos for both candidates trying to negotiate their worth and, frankly, employers trying to set their annual budgets. Mm-hmm. We operate in a market that relies incredibly heavily on titles. We just naturally assume that a specific string of words on a business card, say, financial controller, equates to a universally agreed upon market value.
It doesn't?
No, not at all. When you look at the raw data, that assumption collapses completely. The title tells you almost nothing about the actual mandate.
Which brings us to the source material for today's deep dive. We are looking at a brilliant market insight today, specifically a 2026 report from Byron Thomas Recruitment.
We should clarify, this isn't just a survey of a handful of mates down at the pub.
No. Definitely not anecdotal guesswork. This market insight is built on a massive database of over 120,000 accounting and finance candidates.
That is a phenomenal sample size.
Right. And the overarching hook of this entire report is wonderfully blunt. Having a fancy finance title on your CV might actually tell an employer absolutely nothing about your true market value.
It makes a very compelling case that in Sydney right now, the real salary question isn't whether you hold the title of CFO or, say, finance business partner.
So what is the question then?
The real question is, what do you actually own? What's the scale of the risk you're managing?
Right.
What specific commercial decisions do you influence? And, crucially, what unique capability do you bring to the boardroom table when economic conditions become hostile.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we get into the really juicy numbers, we need to establish the ground rules of how compensation is actually calculated.
Good idea. Because people are constantly comparing apples to oranges.
Constantly. Or in this case, comparing a raw base salary to entirely different heavily conditioned remuneration structures.
Yes.
I always think of it like buying a new car.
Oh, I like this analogy.
Right. So comparing a vague $220,000 package to $220,000 base plus super plus a 20% STI is exactly like comparing a car's bare bones base sticker price to the fully loaded on the road cost.
With all the optional extras and dealer delivery included?
Exactly. The luxury car taxes, the tinted windows, all of it. It's a complete recipe for disaster if you aren't specific. So, how exactly does this Byron Thomas recruitment report define the metrics it uses for its salary bands?
Right. So the sole metric this guide uses for its published salary ranges is the base salary.
Just base.
Just the base. And we need to be incredibly clear on what that means. It represents fixed cash.
The money that actually lands in your current account.
Spot on. It's the cash before employer superannuation is added and before any variable rewards like annual bonuses, car allowances, or stock options are even considered.
So just the fundamental foundation.
Yeah.
The absolute bedrock of the offer.
The bedrock is a brilliant way to look at it, actually. Then sitting entirely separate from that base, you have superannuation.
Right, the retirement fund contribution.
Exactly. And the report notes that as of the 1st of July, 2025, the statutory super guarantee rate in Australia is 12%.
12%, right.
Which is a mandatory employer contribution paid in addition to the base salary, unless the job offer explicitly states that the figure is inclusive of super.
Which is where the confusion so often starts, doesn't it?
I
have heard horror stories of candidates going through a grueling 3-month interview process, getting to the final offer stage, and suddenly realizing the company was talking about an inclusive package the whole time.
Yes, effectively wiping 12% off what the candidate thought was their base take-home pay.
It's devastating.
It happens far more often than you would think. The report explicitly warns both parties, employers and candidates, that they must state the components clearly in distinct dollars and percentages.
So no throwing around the word package.
No, relying on the vague word package is essentially walking into a minefield of miscommunication. And that miscommunication compounds significantly when you introduce the STI.
Right, the short-term incentive. How does the report categorize that?
Well, an STI is a variable reward, typically linked to a combination of annual financial metrics, operational targets, and, of course, individual performance outcomes.
But it's not guaranteed money.
Not at all. The critical nuance the report highlights is the vast chasm between a target STI, a maximum STI, and the actual payment you receive.
Ah, so a candidate might be promised a 20% target STI.
But if the company misses its global revenue hurdle, that STI pool might not fund at all. It is cash at risk.
Wow, okay. And what about the long-term stuff? The report mentions LTIs and equity, which I imagine are much more common at the senior executive level.
They are, yeah, and they come with their own very intricate mechanisms. When we talk about long-term incentives or LTIs, we are usually talking about performance rights or options that are designed to lock an executive in for 3 to 5 years.
Wait, before we go further, you just mentioned vesting conditions when we were prepping for this. For the uninitiated, can we do a quick ELI-5? You know, explain, like, I'm five on how vesting actually works in this context.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like you're being given money that you aren't actually allowed to touch.
That is a very accurate way to describe it. Imagine I promise you 10,000 shares in the company, but the vesting condition is that you must remain employed here for the next 3 years, and the company's share price must outperform our competitors by 10%.
Okay. So what if I leave in year two?
If you leave in year two, or if the company underperforms, those shares vanish.
They just disappear.
They never vest, meaning they never truly become yours to sell. So going back to your car analogy, counting an unvested LTI as part of your guaranteed salary is like assuming you own a car that you are currently just leasing.
And the dealer can take it back if you don't meet their driving criteria.
Exactly.
That makes the distinction incredibly clear. So if an employer or a candidate just throws around the phrase total package, they are being willfully ignorant of the underlying maths.
Right, right.
Now that we have the terminology squared away, let's dive into why applying those base numbers blindly to job titles is fundamentally flawed. Because you can't just walk into a negotiation and say, I am a finance manager, therefore I demand X.
No, you have to look at the scale of the operation.
What's fascinating here is how the report actually divides the market.
Right. The primary dividing line the report uses to categorize these salaries is company turnover.
Just raw revenue.
Yes. They split the market into two distinct buckets. First, you have small to medium organizations, which they define as having a turnover of up to $200 million.
Okay, up to $200 million.
And second, you have large organizations, which are those generating over $200 million.
I hear what you're saying about company size, but I mean, it feels a bit arbitrary, doesn't it?
How so?
Well, if I am a CFO at a highly complex, fast-growing tech startup with $180 million in turnover,
yeah,
am I really inherently worth less than a CFO at a sluggish legacy manufacturing turning over $205 million just because of a line in the sand?
It is a fair challenge, and the report actually acknowledges that a simple turnover threshold is a heuristic. It's a mental shortcut for the broader market.
Right.
However, from a statistical standpoint, across 120,000 data points, crossing that $200 million mark generally triggers a structural shift in how a finance function operates.
What kind of shift?
Well, at that scale, you typically see the introduction of much more complex treasury functions, heavier audit requirements, sophisticated tax structuring, and often a much broader geographic footprint. The complexity of the machine itself fundamentally changes.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's look at how that complexity actually plays out with specific roles, starting right at the top of the food chain, CFOs and finance directors.
The numbers here are eye-watering.
They really are, but the spread is incredibly vast.
It is. Let's take a CFO with 5 or more years of experience in the role. In a small to medium organization, the base salary range is between $200,000 and $300,000.
Which is a solid base.
It is. But if you take that exact same 5 years of experience into a large organization, one over that $200 million threshold, the range explodes. It goes from $350,000 all the way up to $1 million.
$1 million on the base.
Just the base.
That is a gigantic chasm at the upper end. What is actually driving that? Because the title on LinkedIn is identical. They both say chief financial officer.
Well, The title obscures the actual mandate. The report points out that a divisional finance director, a private company CFO, and a listed group CFO carry materially different responsibilities.
Do you break that down?
Sure. Let's look at the daily life of a listed group CFO, meaning a company traded on the Australian Securities Exchange. They are dealing with immense capital requirements, rigorous continuous disclosure laws, intense investor and analyst relations, complex cross-border transactions.
And heavy regulatory risks, I imagine.
Absolutely massive regulatory risks.
So if a private company CFO messes up, the owners are angry. But if an ASX-listed CFO messes up a continuous disclosure obligation, the regulators come knocking, the share price tanks, and they can face personal legal liability.
Spot on. The risk profile is entirely different. A listed CFO is essentially a co-pilot to the CEO in facing the external market, whereas a private company CFO is often much more internally focused on operational efficiency and cash flow.
Yeah, that's a great distinction.
And remember, at that $1 million mark, the base salary is often just the beginning. The short-term incentives and complex vested equity can make the total reward substantially higher.
It really highlights how meaningless the title alone is. And I see this trickles down the hierarchy too. Let's look at financial controllers.
Right.
A controller in a small to medium firm with 1 to 3 years of experience is looking at a base of $120,000 to $150,000.
Standard market rate.
But for a senior controller in a large organization with over 5 years of experience, you're looking at $200,000 to $350,000.
The justification for that higher figure comes down entirely to scope and technical complexity. A financial controller who owns group consolidation, treasury, tax, audit, internal controls, systems upgrades, and manages a large subordinate team.
They just have a completely different market value.
Exactly, compared to someone whose role is heavily siloed into just doing statutory reporting.
Wait, you said group consolidation. Let's do another quick ELI 5 on that for a layperson listening. Is that essentially taking the messy financial results from a dozen different smaller subsidiary companies owned by the main business, dealing with all the different currencies and intercompany loans, and stitching them together into one massive, coherent, legally compliant puzzle.
That is the perfect analogy. And if you get one single piece of that puzzle wrong, the final picture presented to the board and the market is distorted.
Oh, wow. So the liability is huge.
It rests entirely on the financial controller to ensure that consolidated view is flawless.
Yeah.
That is exactly why they command $350,000. If a different candidate is just producing the statutory reports for one single domestic entity, the title might be the same, but the mandate is worlds apart.
It's the same story for finance managers, isn't it?
Yeah.
The report shows a broad range from $90,000 for a junior in a smaller firm up to $200,000 for a highly experienced manager in a large enterprise.
Yes, but it specifically warns employers to test whether the role is a true finance leadership position or just a reporting manager role or perhaps even a financial controller hiding under a different title.
How do they test that?
It all comes down to four pillars. Team leadership, board exposure, commercial ownership, and technical accountability.
Okay.
If you are benchmarking a role as an employer or applying for one as a candidate, you must interrogate the actual work being done. Who do they present to? What decisions can they sign off on without asking permission?
Which brings us to a really interesting anomaly in the report regarding finance business partners.
Ah, yes.
I was scrolling through the tables looking for it, and the report doesn't even list a standalone finance business partner category. They just completely scrubbed one of the most popular titles on LinkedIn.
It is a very deliberate choice by Byron Thomas Recruitment, and honestly, a necessary one. The term finance business partner has become so heavily diluted over the last decade that it now spans multiple completely different classifications of work.
So what do they use instead?
Instead, the report benchmarks senior commercial roles under the title commercial manager.
And a commercial manager with over 5 years of experience in a large organization commands a hefty $250,000 to $450,000 base.
A genuine commercial manager at that level owns the commercial strategy. They are dictating pricing models, leading major contract bids, building complex investment cases for new acquisitions, driving business unit performance, and holding senior operational relationships.
They hold actual decision authority.
Yes. But the report warns that you shouldn't just mechanically apply that massive commercial manager salary to anyone calling themselves a finance business partner.
Right, because of that dilution.
Let's use an analogy. calling yourself a finance business partner when your daily routine is just downloading data from the system and distributing end-of-month reports is a bit like calling yourself an architect when you are just the person handing out the blueprints on the construction site.
Oh, that's brilliant.
The architect actually designs the building. They calculate the load-bearing walls. A true commercial manager designs the commercial strategy and calculates the risk.
So if a so-called business partner is just distributing the reports and has limited decision authority, what are they?
They actually align much more closely with the report's business or commercial analyst bracket.
And that analyst bracket is significantly lower. An analyst with over 5 years of experience in a large firm tops out at around $150,000.
Yeah.
That is a potential $300,000 difference simply based on whether you actually own the commercial decisions or just report on them.
The gap is entirely about accountability. You cannot benchmark someone as though they own high-stakes commercial decisions. If their day-to-day reality involves formatting spreadsheets and checking for variance without understanding the operational drivers behind that variance.
So if a commercial manager is paid to make high-stakes pricing decisions, what happens to the people who are just feeding them the data? The accountants. Because surely their value shifts depending on whether they're just handing over a spreadsheet or actually interpreting it.
Absolutely.
Let's look at the Accounting Foundation. Management accountants in large firms with solid experience sit around the $110,000 to $150,000 mark.
The report notes they increase their value by moving beyond mere month-end production and getting into what they call driver analysis and stakeholder advice.
Let me guess, driver analysis isn't about looking at the company cars.
Not quite, no. Driver analysis means understanding the underlying non-financial metrics that actually drive the financial results.
Give me an example of that.
Well, if revenue is down 10%, a standard accountant will just tell you revenue is down 10%. A management accountant doing driver analysis will tell you that revenue is down because website traffic dropped by 20%, customer conversion fell by 3%, and the average order value decreased by $5.
Oh, I see. They connect the operational reality to the financial outcome.
Exactly. And what about financial accountants? They sit slightly lower at $110,000 to $140,000. Technical complexity dictates the premium there.
Right.
If you have exposure to listed reporting, highly complex tax structures, merger and acquisition integrations, or if you own the external audit process, you can justify pushing towards the very top of that range.
I want to highlight one more specific quirk in this data that I found fascinating, mostly because of what it leaves out. The collections and credit space.
Yes, that's a tricky one.
The report provides benchmarks for a collections manager topping out at $200,000 for highly experienced professionals in large organizations. But there is absolutely no benchmark listed for a national credit manager or a credit risk manager. Why leave out such crucial leadership roles?
Because inventing a benchmark for those roles based on adjacent titles is deeply dangerous for an employer. The report explains that for a national credit manager, companies often look at the national accounts receivable manager ranges as proxy.
And those AR roles go from $85,000 at the junior and up to $250,000 for senior roles in large firms.
But a true national credit role is doing something vastly different to just chasing unpaid invoices, right?
Yeah.
Completely different.
What are they doing, though?
A true national credit manager might own massive insured and uninsured credit limits, set the overarching credit policy for the entire corporation, manage a complex portfolio risk profile, handle high-stakes legal escalations and liquidations, and report directly to the board on credit exposure.
So using the accounts receivable proxy is like paying a heart surgeon based on the average salary of a hospital administrator.
Especially if you are talking about a specialist credit risk manager in financial services or a heavily regulated environment, the mandate is so bespoke that it simply cannot be compared to an accounts receivable leadership role.
So what should employers do?
The report actively advises employers to commission a highly specific role-by-role market assessment for those positions, rather than just guessing based on a loosely related title.
Having established how to actually read this data and look past the titles, let's talk about the market reality. Because understanding your value on paper in a PDF report is one thing, but how does that translate when you actually try to leverage it in the real 2026 job market?
It's a very different landscape out there.
I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second here.
Go for it.
If I am a high-performing finance manager and I decide to jump ship to a new company, shouldn't that move automatically guarantee me a massive 10 to 15% pay bump? Isn't that the accepted wisdom of changing jobs? Especially when my rent in Sydney just went up 15%.
The macro data in this report completely dismantles that assumption. The wider labor market is indeed producing wage growth. The Australian Bureau of Statistics reported an annual wage price index, or WPI, growth of 3.3% up to the March quarter of 2026.
But hang on, if the cost of living is through the roof and the WPI is only 3.3%, moving companies is traditionally the only way to beat inflation. Are you saying candidates just have to swallow a real wage cut because the market won't pay the premium?
The market will pay a premium, but only for highly specific, scarce value. There are no blank checks being handed out simply for signing a new contract. The Reserve Bank of Australia noted in May 2026 that while the labor market remains somewhat tight, firms' hiring intentions have actually moved lower. Employers are being ruthlessly selective. They are scrutinizing what they are getting for that extra 15%.
So if I'm already paid near the top of my salary band, I can't just expect an arbitrary premium to move.
No, you need rock-solid evidence of value. Candidates with scarce capabilities, like leading a successful ERP implementation or navigating a complex merger, might secure a meaningful uplift.
But for everyone else?
Many others might move entirely sideways for a similar base salary because the new role offers better leadership, broader responsibility, or a clearer path to becoming a CFO. You have to weigh the current base against unpaid incentives, flexibility, travel requirements, and the future scope of the new role.
That makes sense.
Moving just for a marginal base increase often leads to a phenomenon where candidates price themselves entirely out of their actual capability level, making them the first target if redundancies occur down the line.
Ouch. What about people who are trying to bring their experience from a completely different context? Say, an expat returning to Sydney from London or New York, or someone trying to change industries entirely. I imagine they look at these salary bands and think, great, I was a VP of finance in London. I slot right in at the top of the Sydney market.
The report calls this the translation challenge. Overseas experience can be incredibly valuable, especially if it involves complex multinational reporting or deep capital markets exposure. But a returning professional cannot simply assume that their overseas title converts directly to the same salary point in Sydney.
Because the Sydney employer needs to understand how that experience actually applies locally. If you are managing UK HACCP accounting standards, does that mean you can handle Australian IFRS equivalents seamlessly?
That is the exact friction point. They need to understand the scale of the previous work, the regulatory environment you operated in, and how it translates to local tax and governance settings. Returning expats need to clearly explain the Australian equivalents of their past roles.
And it is a very similar test for industry changers, I presume.
Very similar.
Let's say I've been a brilliant commercial manager in fast-moving consumer goods selling chocolate bars to supermarkets.
Yeah.
And I want to move into heavy infrastructure construction.
Well, the core finance skills transfer, of course. You know how to build a financial model. You know how to manage a P&L. But learning the sector economics, the revenue recognition models, the union labor agreements, and the specific regulations of a new industry takes significant time.
So you can't just demand top-tier salary day one.
Exactly. The strongest candidates are those who can show exactly where their skills transfer immediately and where they have a credible, accelerated plan to learn the rest. Employers will rarely pay a premium-based salary while they wait 6 months for you to learn their industry's basic economics.
And sometimes the easiest move is no move at all. Which brings us to the fascinating psychology of counteroffers. Let's walk through this scenario. You hand in your notice. You've had enough. Suddenly, your current employer panics, digs into the sofa cushions, and magically finds an extra $20,000 in the budget to convince you to stay. It's incredibly tempting, isn't it?
Oh, it is tempting. But as the report points out, it is almost always a trap. A rushed counteroffer might solve an immediate pay gap, but it rarely fixes the underlying pathology of the role.
What do you mean by pathology?
It doesn't fix a weak role design, a micromanaging boss, a lack of career progression, or a chronically unmanageable workload.
How does that actually play out internally, though? Because if I take that 20 grand, I'm happy, right?
Let's look at the mechanics of how a counteroffer breaks internal equity. When HR scrambles to give you a $20,000 bump, that money doesn't just materialize in a vacuum.
Where does it come from?
It usually comes out of the overarching annual remuneration budget for the broader team. So when December rolls around, your colleagues receive minimal to zero pay rises because you essentially absorb the available pool in July when you threaten to leave.
Wow. You've just become the most expensive and potentially most resented person in the room without even changing your job description.
Furthermore, from the candidate's perspective, you have to ask yourself, has the underlying reason for me wanting to leave genuinely changed? The data suggests that most candidates who accept a counteroffer end up leaving within 12 months anyway because the cultural or workload issues persist.
And from the employer's perspective,
it raises a very uncomfortable question. Why was this person's true market value only recognized after they held a gun to your head with a resignation letter?
If they valued you that much, they should have been paying you properly in the first place.
Retention is strongest when pay is reviewed proactively. A rushed counteroffer often just delays an inevitable departure by a few months, while simultaneously destroying internal equity and trust.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. If routine tasks and standard titles no longer guarantee a premium in this tightening market, and simply jumping ship won't secure a blank check, what skills actually future-proof your career?
Ah, the million-dollar question.
The report references an internal tool called Career Cosmos, which explores how roles are structurally evolving. Where is the premium moving towards in 2026?
The premium is decisively moving away from routine reporting. The production of the numbers is becoming faster, more automated, and frankly, commoditized.
So what's valuable?
The real premium is moving towards professionals who can translate that information into operational decisions. Commercial business partnering, for instance, only adds true value when the professional has the capability to challenge assumptions, explain trade-offs to non-finance leaders, and actually influence what the business does next.
So it's not enough to say, marketing, you overspent your budget by 10%. You need to be able to say, marketing, your customer acquisition cost just spiked, and if we don't reallocate spend to digital channels by Tuesday, we're going to miss our quarterly earnings guidance.
That is the exact shift from reporting to influencing. The same applies to transformation experience. It is no longer enough to just list an ERP software implementation on your CV.
What do you need to show?
You have to prove you delivered measurable outcomes. A faster month end close by 3 days, stronger internal controls, or visibly improved cash conversion cycles. You have to prove you can connect finance processes with data governance and ensure user adoption across the wider business.
We have to address the elephant in the room here, don't we? Generative AI.
We do.
It feels like every professional I speak to is slightly paranoid that a hyper-intelligent algorithm is going to take their job within the next 3 years.
The Byron Thomas Recruitment Report tackles this directly, citing comprehensive research from Jobs and Skills Australia. Their conclusion is that generative AI is far more likely to augment finance jobs than to replace them entirely.
Augment, not replace. Let's dig into that distinction, because an AI can certainly write a variance report faster than I can.
It can. What AI does is increase the baseline importance of digital literacy while simultaneously placing a massive premium on what we call human skills.
Okay, let's walk through an AI scenario.
Right. You are a commercial manager modeling a potential merger. An AI can run 10,000 Monte Carlo simulations on the valuation in 3 seconds. It can highlight the statistical anomalies in the target company's ledger.
So what does the human do?
An AI cannot sit in the boardroom, look the CEO in the eye, navigate their emotional attachment to a vanity project, explain the strategic trade-offs, and take personal, professional accountability for advising them to walk away from the deal.
Human skills. So judgment, influence, empathy, and accountability. The things an algorithm fundamentally lacks.
Exactly. Tool familiarity is a baseline expectation now, but judgment and accountability remain central to senior finance value. The AI provides the synthesis. The human provides the strategy and carries the risk.
So we've talked extensively about the candidate side, how to navigate these bands and prove your value. But flipping the script, how should companies actually utilize all this data? Because employers are clearly struggling.
This raises an important question. How do they use this insight so they don't end up wildly overpaying for an inflated title, or conversely, underpaying and losing out on top talent?
Right.
The report lays out a very clear employer playbook. First and foremost, write the mandate around the outcomes, the authority, and the risks before you even choose a job title. Benchmark the actual work required to achieve the company's strategic goals.
Not the label you think sounds good on a job advert.
Exactly right. And when you are benchmarking that work, keep base salary, superannuation, and incentives entirely separate in your communications.
Yes, to avoid that inclusive package mess we talked about earlier.
Spot on. Use the company size, that $200 million turnover threshold we discussed, as your first input. But then you must adjust the figure based on the specific context. the size of the finance team, the geographic spread of the operations, the regulatory burden of your industry, and the commercial scope you're handing to this person.
And what about the internal equity trap? Let's say a company has had the same loyal finance manager for 10 years. They're paying them $130,000, well below the 2026 market rate we've seen today.
Yes.
When that loyal manager finally retires, the company can't just use that outdated $130,000 salary to benchmark a new external hire, surely.
That is a critical error many companies make. It is the incumbent trap. You must test for internal equity amongst your current team, but you absolutely cannot let an outdated incumbent salary define your view of the external live market.
Because it just won't work.
If you try to hire a new finance manager in Sydney in 2026 for $130,000 simply because that's what John used to earn, you will simply fail to hire. The market has moved on.
The report has a stark warning on this that really stood out to me. It explicitly says the cheapest accepted offer is not always the best commercial outcome. That feels counterintuitive for finance people whose job is often to minimize costs.
Let's calculate the hidden costs of a failed search. If an employer tries to save $10,000 on a base salary by lowballing the market, what happens? They narrow their candidate field to those who are desperate or underqualified.
Right. The good ones walk away.
The position sits vacant for an extra 3 or 4 months. The existing team burns out covering the workload. Important strategic projects stall. The company might have to hire an expensive interim contractor. And if the cheaper candidate they eventually hire fails to perform, they have to start the whole process again, paying recruitment fees twice.
So trying to save 10 grand up front ends up costing $100,000 in lost productivity, contractor fees, and general chaos.
It is a profound false economy. The objective for an employer shouldn't be to secure the cheapest human capital possible. The objective is to build a remuneration package that matches the real work required, and one that can be explained consistently and transparently to the candidates, the existing finance team, and the board. Pay for the capability that delivers the outcome.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? If we synthesize everything we've pulled from this Byron Thomas recruitment market insight, the core thesis for navigating the Sydney finance market in 2026 is brutally clear. Your value is not determined by the title on your business card or the label on your LinkedIn profile.
Not anymore.
Your value is determined by the specific commercial decisions you own, the tangible risks you manage, the operational scale of your organization, and your purely human ability to translate raw financial data into decisive operational action. The title is just a convenient wrapper. The mandate you execute is the actual product.
It represents a massive, necessary shift from pure credentialism to proven capability. The Sydney market in 2026 is paying a premium for professionals who can navigate extreme complexity, manage risk, and influence tangible outcomes, regardless of what they happen to be called internally.
Which leaves me with a thought I would love for you to ponder as we wrap up today's deep dive. We've established that AI is rapidly consuming the routine elements of financial reporting. We've established that relying on job titles to determine compensation is a deeply flawed, outdated heuristic.
True.
So, if we extrapolate this trend over the next decade, will the CV of the future drop job titles entirely? Instead of lazily listing yourself as a senior commercial manager and hoping an employer guesses what you did, will your future CV just be a stark ledger of the specific high-stakes human decisions you have successfully made, a list of the crises you averted and the value you created? It is certainly something to think about as you navigate your own career cosmos in the years ahead. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the 2026 market. We will see you next time.